abierto de lunes a jueves. You
the Safari Park. You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in applause and cheers? I think not. Well, it's over. Now what? As we mentioned in the previous show, the holidays mostly suck, and the suckiest of them all is New Year's, by far. That Christmas tree is as brown as the fruitcake at the bottom of the trash bin. The best has come and gone, and now we face the worst of any holiday on the calendar. Now, I've promised to tell you how I survived New Year's with the mob, and I will. But first, we have to put together a bit of kind of a context for it, so stay with me. You know, there's only one standard New Year's song, and it's a damn dirge, right? That old Lang Syne thing. Well, there are others, but I'll get to those later. If New Year's is about looking ahead, okay, but screw retrospection. Retrospection is stupid because it can lead to nostalgia, which is painful. Now, what's the etymology of the word nostalgia? I'm not going to pretend I know this offhand like that pompous Canuck Alex Trebek. The word's from the Greek nostros, meaning return home, and algos, meaning pain. So even the ancient Greeks knew looking back causes pain. First, you get a crick in your neck, then you get a lump in your throat. So why do we do it? Let's try to figure it out. You know, in college, there was a madman classmate of mine everybody called Fantasy Frank. He was, he was out there. But like most madmen, he had moments of extreme clarity, even brilliance. I recall making a beer run with him in his red velvet padded Chevy van, which he called his fuck truck. We were getting on a freeway that had a very short entrance ramp. Merging was hazardous as hell, under the best of circumstances. As I sat there riding shotgun, I looked over at Frank. His left arm hung out the driver's window. Some heavy metal track was blasting from his speakers. His wild man of Borneo hair was whipping his face, sometimes covering his eyes, and then I noticed it. There was no side view mirror. The van had no rear windows, and I instantly ascertained, as Frank floored the accelerator, that this could be my last ride. "Hey, Frank," I shouted, have a look over your shoulder before you merge, will ya?" Frank took a heroic drag on his cigarette, turned his head toward me and smiled. "Hey man, why look back? That's history." Well, I'm still here. Don't know if Frank is. But he had a very salient point. Looking back blows. Even if you've just won a lottery, an Oscar, a Super Bowl, what the hell are the odds of repeating it? How are you going to top that? And maybe you didn't have such a stellar year. Maybe you screwed up a lot. Lost more than you won. You want to look back on that wreckage? Hell no. But we all do it, don't we? We stand up from the toilet and we just gotta take a peek over the cheek. What the hell for? If you swallowed a diamond, okay. Get yourself a putty knife and a jeweler's loop and get busy. But really, what are we expecting to see? But something within us won't let us leave the past behind. We simply must look back and examine and parse and analyze. We need to stop that shit. It's counterproductive. Don't look back. The news shows insist on recapping all the celebrity deaths in the past year and the catastrophes, and we do it ourselves, now more than at any time in the history of the planet. Thanks to our smartphones, every facet of our lives is documented, every call, every text, every email logged, and that's all involuntary. What about the 128 gigs of selfies in there? Of whipped cream designs on Frappuccinos and your videos of your Pomeranian's epileptic seizures and pinworms squirming around your kid's butthole, and on and on and on. Thanks to digital documentation, nobody even gets away with murder anymore. Even though we know damn well some victims needed killing. But if the perpetrator is a cell phone, the cops triangulate and extrapolate his exact time and location, thanks to transponder pings. There's a TV show, there was a cable show, it was called The Black Mirror. And it took this phenomenon a step further. As I said, a step, because I don't believe it's a leap, it's just a couple of baby steps, where people have cameras implanted in their corneas and multi-terabyte drives embedded in their neck that record every waking and sleeping moment of their lives. Imagine the living hell that will be. To be able to watch yourself without benefit of memory distortion, which we all use, don't we, to rationalize and mitigate our fuck-ups. Imagine watching ourselves screw up that big job interview or alienate the hot chick who actually seemed interested in us or wreck your shiny new automobile. Think of the insurance companies demanding to view your eyeball recordings.
Sorry, claim denied. You were looking at a female pedestrian's big ass when you rear-ended that school bus.
It's like we all live in a TiVo box, and our every movement is available on instant replay, so we actually live in the past, don't we? And to be clear, anyone who says we need to live in the present hasn't really looked at the concept of time very closely. Just follow that second hand on an analog watch. It never, ever pauses. Is there a present? Doesn't look that way. Only past and future. But New Year's is the same thing. Kind of low-tech, isn't it? Maybe it's some need in our species to archive and review. I'm a big archivist. I've got hundreds of gigs of my kids from birth to right now. You know when I look at those images? Never. Sometimes I have to search my computer and I stumble over a picture of one of my kids from a few years ago, and the feeling is pure argos, to quote the Greeks. It's never good. I love my kids more than life. Do I want to be reminded of the fact that they're no longer toddlers? Hell no. And so we have this irresistible compulsion to look back. Can you remember any or many New Year's Eves? What makes them stick out in your mind, and when you do recall them, how do you feel? If it was a great memory, that's nice. But if your current reality doesn't measure up, it probably makes you feel shitty. And if it was a crappy New Year's, well, who wants to wallow in that disaster? Maybe you do what I do, and this is more of a subconscious activity. You scroll backward through those memories, and the moment you find one that's too warm and happy, you skip over it because that comparison to the present may not be a good one. Then you stumble on a painful one and flip right past it. Oh, you close that browser fast. So instead, why not just pick one that was fascinating, but not necessarily positive or negative? Just crazy or bizarre or one of a kind. And so it was such a New Year's Eve when I lived in New York. Now, since women invariably set the social agenda, and men are just jellyfish swept along in their whirlpool. Isn't that true? Of course it is. The moment you get involved with some chick, your previous social life ends and you are subsumed into hers. Your best friend from kindergarten, remember that guy, the one that carried you unconscious from a burning building? Who the hell is that? Oh, and the other guy, the one that took a bullet for you in Kabul. What's his name again? You forget all about them. And you're absorbed into her circle. Well, I was with her at a party at her best friend's place. We'll call her best friend, Linda. And Linda's husband was a nice guy, a fun guy. We'll call him Tony. Tony's father happened to be the number two man in one of New York's notorious five families. And I'm not telling you which one, but it was definitely not the Bananos, Lucchese's, or Columbo's, okay? Now, like I said, Tony was a very personable guy. Easy to like. Easy to get along with. And damn funny. He could really crack you up. And while most of us were fresh out of college, starving, taking the subway, or driving ratbag cars, Tony was fresh out of jail and driving a new Cadillac. He also owned a nice home. and a vacation home, and took the most banging Caribbean vacations you could possibly imagine. He, Tony would not have pissed on the best part of Club Med. No. He'd rent his own cliffside villa in Barbados. I attended Tony and Linda's wedding. It was crazy. Over the top. They didn't just have a band. They had a comedian, a guy whose name you'd recognize, and a magician, and guys on unicycles juggling flaming bowling pins. It was Vegas on steroids. On the way to the catering joint, there was a van, not a fuck truck, this was more of a fuck you truck, filled with FBI guys, with a video camera on a tripod, and they were openly recording each guest walking into that reception hall. Wise guys were flipping them off and giving them a Bronx cheer. It was surreal. The FBI guys, they stared and squinted at me and scratched their heads like, what the hell? What is this red-haired, skinny Irish kid doing here? I suppose if I ever decide to run for president, I'm screwed. Some G-man will dig that tape out of the vault and say, look, he's a documented associate of organized crime. But let's get back to New Year's Eve. So Tony's a nice guy, and we were pals. But outside of me and my girlfriend, almost everyone at this New Year's Eve party is, in the family business. And Tony, that's personable, amusing Tony, was an anomaly. Most of the other guys there looked as if they would stick your head in a vise so they could use your face for target practice. I'm talking lethal. And some of them are talking shop. And since they never know who's wired, it's all in that vague Joe Pesci patois.
Hey, you know that thing that we did before the other thing with Frank Cassell? No, not that thing. The other thing. Yeah, well, we got to do that thing again because the other thing wasn't exactly, what the thing the boss wanted, okay?
So I'm sitting on the L-shaped crushed velour sectional couch next to the girlfriend of one of Tony's bodyguards. And Tony had two bodyguards. They were Joey and Mikey. By the way, in New York, in wise guy parlance, everybody gets an E tacked on to the end of their names, which works okay with names like Frank and Sal and Jim and Joe. What do they do with the Williams and the Arthurs? Well, they just scrap your first name entirely and give you a nickname like Itchy Ball Smith or Limp Dick Jones. Now, bodyguard Mikey looked like a cruiserweight, well put together, with a permanent expression on his face that said, "Don't fuck with me." Joey, on the other hand, Joey looked like the missing link in a three-piece suit. Now, I have a talent. I can look at anyone and tell you his or her weight within 5 pounds, usually within 2 pounds. And no amount of Spanx or Kardashian body shapers will throw off my laser-accurate estimates, which always ensures me an income on a boardwalk or carnival, but makes women very wary of me. So when I give you these folks' descriptions, you can rest assured of their accuracy. Now, Joey was only around 5'10" or 5'11", but he tipped the scales at 245, and when I say he looked like an ape, I'm not exaggerating, not even a little. His inseam was maybe 15 inches, so he moved like a weeble. And knuckle dragging? Yeah. He could tie his shoes and not bend his spine. And those hands, well, Seth Meyers would give his career to have the hair from the backs of Joey's hands on his head. And Joey's neck, well, there really was no neck. His head just kind of grew out of his shoulders. So I'm sitting there, and cruiserweight bodyguard Mikey is explaining to Simeon Joey how he was pissed off at his girlfriend when they were at a club the other night. So Mikey went into the men's room to blow off a little steam. No, it's not what you're thinking. Mikey washed his hands and then decided to rip the sink off the wall. He was half complaining, half laughing how the water ruined his new suit. Come to think of it, Mikey never said what he did with that sink. Did he carry it out of the bathroom and walk around with it like some old-time cigarette girl at the Copacabana? Hey, yous, you need to wash your hands. No, I ain't got no towels. Get your own fucking towel, you asshole. Hey, wear this sink over your fucking head, you fucking asshole. Another thing about the boys back in New York, for some unknown reason, they always substituted Z's for the S's in words like asshole. I have no idea why. Now, as Mikey is explaining the art of barehanded plumbing, I'm looking, discreetly, stealing looks, you might say, at Joey's date. She's very cute in that sort of peroxide blonde gun mall way. Nothing you'd bring home to Mom, but quite pointy. What's pointy, you ask? It's a term I've invented to describe chicks of a certain look, and Joey's date had it. She was maybe 112 pounds, and almost every part of her came to a point. Her shoes, her fingernails, the corners of her eyes, her boobs. Now there's a half gallon of Johnny Walker Red on the coffee table in front of the crushed velour L-shaped sectional. And Joey's 112-pound pointy girlfriend is filling her tumbler with Johnny and chugging it like iced tea. And I'm thinking to myself, this chick's legs aren't just pointy, they're hollow too. It was incredible. She's out-drinking Joey the silverback gorilla by a factor of 5, and she's still upright. Suddenly, some chick screams, "Yo, everybody, it's New Year's!" And I'm thinking, all eyes will turn to the TV, where Dick Clark is starting the 10-second countdown. Well, I was wrong. Instead of watching the ball drop, pistols are whipped from waistbands and ankle holsters as windows fly open, and it looks like a fucking war with the bananas, and I'm gonna die in it. The gats go out the window, point to the sky, and...
Hey, happy fucking New Year. You like noisemakers? I'll show you fucking... Listen to this noisemaker, you fucking asshole. Happy fucking New Year.
It was like Friday night in Fallujah. Well, after they emptied the magazines, they took their seats again. And I'm noticing Joey's pointy girlfriend isn't looking so pointy. In fact, her head is resting on Joey's pinstripe shoulder, and her eyes are almost closed. Okay, she had about a quart too much to drink, but still, she's a gun moll. She's probably one tough chick, right? Then something curious happens. There's a flume of thick, white fluid flowing from pointy girl's mouth down Joey's shoulder and pooling in his breast pocket. I'm wondering when he's going to notice and what his reaction will be. Then he reaches for a cigarette inside that breast pocket and notices his bratwurst-sized fingers are deep, deep into girlfriend's upchuck. He looks at his fingers, which are now webbed with what appears to be pancake batter. He blinks. I can see the synapses and neurons firing from his fingers trying to reach his brain. Those nerve impulses are telling him, Joey, your girlfriend is vomiting on your new Hugo Boss double-breasted. I look at her face and think, whoa, a pointy chick could do a Jimi Hendrix right about now. That puke is as thick as tomato paste. And if she sucks a wad into her lungs, suddenly Joey's brain gets the message. And he's on his feet. When he stands, pointy girl falls over, face down, on the L-shaped crushed velour sectional. And Joey bellows, "You fucking bitch! You fucking bitch! Look what you done on my new suit!" Another chick, somewhat less pointy, rushes over, and she and my girlfriend pick up unconscious pointy girl and race her into the bathroom to revive her. Each has her under an arm, and her feet drag along the carpet. Suddenly, her eyes pop open, and she projectile vomits across the room onto the Sony where Dick Clark is smiling and waving live from Times Square.
"Boss, look what she done to the TV. This bitch is embarrassing me."
Tony's dad was upper management, while Joey was strictly boiler room. Tony got it that the only person embarrassing Joey was Joey.
Shut the fuck up and look after your girlfriend, Joey. I can get another fucking TV, and Sue's dry clean up just fine.
Tony had a little class, but Joey's antecedents needed a few more thousand years of interbreeding with Homo sapiens before they were ready for civilization. Looking back, Pointy Chick's condition and Joey's chivalry really didn't slow the party down much. In fact, it was kind of anticlimactic after that 21-gun salute. So, after a few minutes in the bathroom with the two girls working on her, Pointy Chick was brought to a semblance of consciousness. She was returned to her spot on the crushed velour L-shaped sectional couch. And Joey, he disappeared somewhere, I don't know, probably renewing his membership in NOW. Now, I'm sitting about three ass widths away from Pointy Chick, anticipating that just maybe she had not yet expelled the full 32 ounces of Johnny Red I'd seen her consume. And a slightly blurry Dick Clark appears to be winding down the show. Somebody must have wiped down the TV screen. And suddenly, with the force of a coconut from a tall palm tree, Pointy Chick's unconscious head falls into my lap, just as Joey weebles himself into the room. Now I'm pretty sure I'm dead. Joey's eyes were blazing, but they were so beady, so deep set, I really wasn't sure whether he was staring at me or Pointy Chick. He glares at her unconscious head in my lap, then grabs one of her delicate wrists in one hand and her belt in another and hoists her across his shoulder, perfect legs in front, her bubble ass in the air, and her head, torso, and limp arms hanging down Joey's massive back. And he heads for the door. Well, this sudden change in position and altitude was just enough to trigger peristalsis in Pointy Chick. And once again, the pancake batter flows from her lips, this time down the back of Joey's pant leg. I have to know where he's taking her, so I follow. Out the front door he goes, out onto the street, where he plops Pointy Chick's semi-conscious body across the hood of his Lincoln like a dead deer. Then he fishes the key from his pocket and opens the rear door and just airmails Pointy Chick into the back seat. Mikey, the cruiserweight, has now joined me on the front stoop to gawk at this scene.
Hey, Joey, don't be sitting down at town car to use cleans the puke off of your ass.
Ooh, Joey looks behind himself and sees he's once again been anointed by Pointy Chick's pancake batter. In renewed fury, he wheels around and brings his fist down on the hood of his car. I mean, it puckers like it's been hit with a wrecking ball. I was actually a bit surprised it didn't flip like a tiddlywink, like in that Hellboy movie. Joey jumps in and floors it into the snowy night. Would they find Pointy Chick's body in a dumpster, an alley, or the river? I looked at Mikey, but I thought I'd better not ask him. Now I'm really ready to leave, but the girls have, as they have to have, I should say, as they call it, coffee and cake. There are probably some cannolis and Napoleons on the table as well. It's always de rigueur. Wrap up to those little gatherings. They talk about their clothes and hair and nails, and then about how shitty the clothes, hair, and nails are of their friends who couldn't make the party. And finally, coats are being donned when the doorbell rings. It's about 2:30 a.m. It's not FedEx with a late delivery. Columbo's with a hand grenade? FBI raid? Do the feds even ring doorbells? Tony nods at Mikey, who whips his heater from his ankle holster and looks through the peephole.
It's fucking Joey!
The door opens and Joey enters. Only Tony has the balls and the authority to ask the multi-million-dollar question.
Joey, how's your date? I took that bitch home to her mother's, and I told her she was an embarrassment, and she should learn to hold her fucking liquor.
Is that it? Asked Tony.
No, I told her Happy New Year, of course.
And so with the fragrance of gunpowder infused in my Christmas sweater, my girlfriend and I departed Tony's house. And whether Tony, Joey, Mikey, Pointy Chick, or even my ex-girlfriend are still on this side of the dirt is anybody's guess. But when I look back on that New Year's Eve, I don't feel happy. I don't feel sad. I just feel amazed that I lived to tell you about it. Now, I promised you earlier to talk about New Year's songs, and there's been a bunch of them from people like U2 and Mariah, Kid Rock, the Foo Fighters, and so on. The most interesting and algos-triggering one in the bunch may be that of the late Dan Fogelberg. It was called The Same Old Lang Syne. And what makes it interesting is the fact that it's actually a mashup. By his own admission, Dan penned fresh lyrics over a slowed-down version of that old romantic tune, Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. And if you listen to it, you'll hear it. Then it morphs into the traditional Auld Lang Syne with some pretty clever sax by another late guy named Michael Brecker. And what makes the song so damn powerful is it's a true story. Dan was actually making a New Year's beer run to a 7-Eleven when he bumped into an old girlfriend. And for a while, it seems the flicker might turn to flame.
Met my old lover in the grocery store. The snow was falling Christmas Eve. I stole behind her in the frozen foods and I touched...
Even that sentimental slob, Ape Man Joey, probably got a lump in his 32-inch throat upon hearing this song. Perhaps he wished he'd been a tad more gentle with Pointy Chick. And so, my friends, my message to you this New Year's is one I bring you courtesy of Fantasy Frank. Don't look back. Ah, but who are we kidding? We're human beings. It's what we do. And as we travel this highway of life, it may be wise to be a bit more like Tony and a little less like Joey. So that when we're geezers sitting in the sun and we look back, we'll feel less of that algos. Now, this is the sophomore outing of That Larry Show, and I'd be remiss if I didn't thank the people who made it possible. First, the inimitable Dick Masterson of the incredible Dick Show. I've co-hosted with Dick 3 times now, and each session is more fun than the last. And it's due to Dick's very generous plugs that most of you are hearing me right now. Thank you, Dick. Also, I want to thank the fantastic folks who support this show through Patreon. They keep the lights on at That Larry Show, and I am so very grateful to them. The reaction has been just staggering so far, and I've not time to list everyone, but let me just shout out to the bold and brave and tasteful, the Patreons who are among the very first to step up and pledge allegiance to the show. I'll just use an initial for the surnames to protect the innocent. Thank you, Amidao, Tim the Enchanter, ACIOU, Michael Juan P, Stephen L, Juanita C, Vidal S, Charlie W, Michael T, Alexander S, Kellen S, Nathan Z, Jesse E, Sarah M, and Christopher G. We salute you all. If you want to get in touch, leave us a voicemail at 302-71-LARRY or shoot us an email at thatlarryshow@gmail.com. Be sure to click the subscribe button on thatlarryshow.com or at patreon.com/thatlarryshow. That way, you'll never, ever miss an episode. See you next time, and Happy New Year.